General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
The late President Ronald Reagan. We're going to be talking with Uwe Simonetto here in the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc., getting his reflections as a native of Germany, as one, if I remember his story correctly, who as a young man, a very young man, we would say a child, was smuggled out of East Germany. We're going to be talking to him about the fall of the Berlin Wall and his reflections on not only that event, but on the life of Ronald Reagan. He joins us here the week after the nation has mourned the loss of Ronald Reagan and witnessed, well, what was really a week-long celebration, both of his contributions to our nation, but also his funeral service. Uwe Simonetto also joins us here during this religion roundup, the first 25 minutes, to talk about D-Day politics. What was Gerhard Schroeder doing there last, Sunday before last, on the beaches in celebration of D-Day? And we'll talk to him a bit about Saint Boniface, a German saint who is actually an English-speaking missionary who brought Christianity to the German people. We'll also talk about President Bush's recent visit with Pope John Paul II, his audience before the Pope, and I believe he gave the President the Medal of Freedom on that day. All that with Uwe Simonetto here in the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Feel free to join us at any point in our conversation. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. A little bit later in this hour, Dr. James Hitchcock and his wife, Helen Hull Hitchcock, join us to talk about this week's meeting in Denver of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. One of the things that it is rumored the Catholic bishops will discuss, they don't necessarily promise to do anything, but they will discuss what's going on among some of the bishops, two in particular, Raymond Burke and I think it's Bishop Sheridan in Colorado Springs. They have, in to one degree or another, at least publicly said that Roman Catholic lawmakers who are pro-choice should not be receiving communion. And in the case of the bishop there in Colorado Springs, even Roman Catholic faithful who have voted for such lawmakers should also, if they do not repent, be denied communion. The bishops will take up that subject, among other things, this week in Denver. We'll be talking about that with James and Helen Hull Hitchcock in the second part of this first hour. We've got open lines for your questions and your comments. Lots of sound from the Reagan funeral on Friday. We'll concentrate mostly, we'll do, you know, a bit of a potpourri from that, but we'll concentrate mostly on Jack Danforth's homily at the Reagan funeral, and of course the parting words of Reagan's home pastor, Pastor Venning. We'll be talking about that. And then in the last half hour of Issues Etc., I'd like your reaction, by the way, to some of the things you may have seen and heard at the Reagan funeral on Friday, as it was held in Washington, D.C. at the National Cathedral. Then in the last half hour of the program, Suzanne Venker joins us for part six of our seven-part series on working mothers. Today we're going to talk about daycare. Do your children love daycare? Will they look back on their childhood and fondly remember their hours, sometimes their days, in daycare? We'll talk about that with Suzanne Venker. Again, our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Uwe Simonetto is a native of Germany. He is religion editor for United Press International. He joins us today from Dresden, Germany. Uwe, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Great to be back.
Uwe, first of all, what brings you to Dresden? What have you been? How have you been spending your time there?
Well, Todd, yes, you know, I'm Saxon, and Dresden is the Saxon capital. And I just had to do a quick tour down here because the Church of Our Lady, this beautiful Baroque church that was destroyed in February 41 in the air raid on Dresden when most of Dresden was leveled, of course, is being rebuilt. And actually, it is rebuilt. It's one of the most magnificent feats, against even the will of the church authorities or anybody, by a private initiative, the largest Protestant church ever built as a Protestant church has been rebuilt. Now, the top of it is sitting there right outside my window here. It's going to be lifted up on the next Sunday, if the weather is right, there's an 800-ton crane out waiting to lift it up with this marvelous cross donated by the British, and made by the son of one of the bomber pilots who destroyed Dresden 45. And I think it's worth a pilgrimage to do this. It's one of the most hopeful things ever that, even against the will of the state church, because they thought, well, that wasn't necessary, there were enough churches in all that sort of, and people actually from private nations, from people's pockets, $10 here, $5 there, somebody, $10,000, from all over the world. I mean, there are pilgrims now outside. Japanese, everybody wants to see this spectacular feat of this massive church being rebuilt.
Uwe, what was left of Dresden after Allied bombing late in the war, and why is the rebuilding of this particular church so significant?
Well, because first of all, Dresden, which was one of the most beautiful cities in Europe, and probably and certainly the most beautiful city in Germany, and had no strategic value, no munitions factories, yet nothing. It was leveled. It was a war crime. It was a war crime committed by the Allies in 1945, which certainly the British acknowledge now. And there's a great sense of shame. I mean, I'm married to an English woman, and I know England very well. There's always been a great sense of shame for this massive crime that's been committed here. They only give an official figure of 35,000 people who died that night. Actually, the number is more likely 135,000 people. They created firestorms, and women and children were sucked in these storms. And the reason for the difference in numbers is that Dresden streets at the time were filled with refugees from Germany's eastern provinces, which are now part of Poland and Russia. And you know, this it was a slaughter of civilians, of women and children, and of course of splendid architecture, Baroque architecture, created by a king, Augustus Strong, mainly in the 18th century.
Uwe, as a native of Germany, and with much of your early life caught up in the lack of freedom that prevailed after the Second World War, give us your thoughts on what role former President Ronald Reagan, whose passing we've observed this last week, what role did he play in the tearing down of the Berlin Wall? Your thoughts on that and on his role in the unification of Germany?
Well, I'm in a minority here. I was in a minority then. Now everybody probably recognizes that. He was much maligned, as you know, at the time here by the left and by the media in Europe, as Bush is being maligned now. When he showed up, first of all, when he realized that the only way to destroy the Soviet Empire and reunify Europe was to stare down the Soviets and to arm up to the hilt against the Soviet threat, he realized that was one of his topics. And with that, he reunified because the Soviets could no longer hold on to the speed of arming up with these SS-20 missiles all aimed at us. Then, of course, he actually was one of the very few was the only leader who said, when he went to Berlin, said, "Mr. President," meaning Gorbachev at the time, "tear down this wall." Everybody else thought, you know, this was a given that Germany and Europe would be divided forever or for a very, very long time to come, and one had to live with it, accommodate the communists, and Reagan said no. So it was that moment that actually kicked off the process led to the reunification of Europe and of Germany.
And during that process, when it became evident to you, Uwe, very briefly, that the wall, the actual wall, was going to come down and Germany was going to be reunified, what were those times like for you as a native of Germany?
It was just wonderful. I was living in the States at the time, and I came over when it happened. You see, and I actually was a correspondent for the Associated Press in Berlin in 1961 when the wall was built. And I hate to admit, but I was very dubious that this thing would ever come down in my lifetime. And to see it being dismantled overnight was one of the most joyful events. It filled me with so much joy, as this church being rebuilt right now fills me with joy. And this is what, these are the sort of key events in the human life.
Uwe Simonetto is our guest. He's religion editor for United Press International. He joins us from Dresden, Germany, also a native of Germany as well. Our regular religion roundup. Another thought that was in the news most recently, and that was the president's visit to an audience with Pope John Paul II and his awarding to the Pope the Medal of Freedom, I believe. Your thoughts on this, Uwe?
Well, I followed it from a distance because I was doing other things at the time, but I thought it was an absolutely spectacular event. Yes, I thought it was very gracious the way Bush handled that. I mean, the Pope has been very critical of the United States policy on Iraq, on off the war, etc. I thought Bush handled himself exceedingly well and elegantly in doing that. So I was quite impressed, and I think many of my friends here were too.
At the end of the first week of this month, Uwe, there was really an international celebration of the Operation Overlord, which we know as, at least from our context, the storming of the Normandy beaches, and for Americans and the Allies in particular, the beach at Omaha. The celebration there was attended by many dignitaries. What was German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder doing there?
Well, I was wondering about that. I thought it was totally inappropriate that he went. I fully agree with many of the British and the Canadian and other veterans who said as long as a veteran is still alive and who participated in this, this should not be a place where a German chancellor should go. He was invited by a French president, Chirac, but it seemed to be a sort of in a sense of sticking it to the Americans or to Bush. It was playing politics with something that shouldn't have been political at all. It is these soldiers who participated in this died, were wounded and watched their bodies die, should have been allowed to do this, to commemorate this one last time. That's certainly the last big celebration. And then, when this generation has passed, then, of course, by all means, the Germans, who also benefited, obviously, from the Allied victory in World War II, should be represented, and the German Chancellor should be there. But in a sense of, look, we've reconciled a long time ago, especially the French and the Germans. There was no need, I think, for making such a scene. It was unseemly. I didn't like it. But I mean, again, I'm in a minority here, and it's not that I feel a personal sense of guilt for World War II because I wasn't part of the generation that had anything to say in this entire thing because I was born 3 years before World War II started. It is simply that one should allow people's memories and soldiers' memories. One should have enough respect for the feelings of these old guys to stay away and pay one's respects differently.
I want to talk a bit in that connection, the European connection, about the European Union. Today, there was a decision made in the courts that a challenge to our Pledge of Allegiance to try and have the words "under God" omitted. Strangely enough, on the 50th anniversary to the day of when the words were inserted into our Pledge of Allegiance, that seems to have gone nowhere. The person who had brought the suit asking for the words to be removed was found to not have any legal standing to have brought the suit. In the European Union, they are undergoing their own debate, have, about whether or not God should get mentioned in any way whatsoever in their documents. Tell us about that.
Or God should be mentioned, or even Christianity should be mentioned. Christianity's role in the shaping of European civilization. Look, here's something very, very funny going on. And that is, it's primarily the French who do this. And as you know, I'm very fond of France, but they're nuts on this. They are so rigid about it because their doctrine is laïcité, which means lay or secularized structure of state, and where church, where God should not be mentioned, and to omit all this. When anybody who comes to France or comes to Europe, the only thing you see is the evidence of the Christian heritage here. The great cathedrals, the churches around you, everything, the way we act and talk, is crazy beyond belief. I hope to God that the newcomers, especially countries like Poland and Malta and others, will bring the rest of Europe to their senses on this issue. But it's the intransigence, especially of the French and the Belgians, curiously enough. Germans, of course, have God in their constitution. Their very first sentence, our constitution mentions our responsibility before God and our fellow man. It's an ongoing struggle. I think ultimately they will have to cope with this more elegantly than they've been trying to.
And coming back to German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder, is it true that he was unwilling to speak kind of the traditional "so help me God" in his oath of office?
He was the first chancellor since 1949. Not to have mentioned God in his wearing his oath of office, with the traditional formula, "so help me God." And indeed, I think a majority, if not almost a majority, of his cabinet refused to do that. Very unattractive. And, these are the 1968 types. These are the people who, in the 1960s, early 70s, decided on a long march. These were the student rebels at the time, on a long march to the institutions, including the church and everything else, and they've succeeded. Now they're making a thorough mess. As you noticed, of course, from your papers, the same guys have suffered massive setbacks, both in European and state elections. The Social Democrats have now been reduced to a minority party, and they only govern because the constitution is so strong state and other elections do not necessarily affect the government. But actually, the Social Democrats are a minority now, a tiny minority, as against the Christian Democrats and others.
I noted, Uwe, in the news several weeks ago that Pope John Paul II was in attendance at another youth rally. This seems to be kind of, these are must-attend events for him. He has been a pope that's reached out to the youth, and he was, at least according to the news coverages that came over here, was just enthusiastically received by these youth. I would like you, if you would, to both comment on that and compare that to the fact that the president whose passing we have remembered in this last week, Ronald Reagan, had a similar, even being one of the oldest presidents serving, had a similar relationship with his country's youth as this pope seems to have with his church's youth.
Yes, well, this is most remarkable. Both Reagan and of course the Pope provide the youth with something that the youth desperately want, and that is somebody to look up to, somebody to rally to, somebody they can trust, somebody they can emulate. And all these nasty little petty politicians don't provide that symbol. But the Pope, he has this old Pope, he can barely talk, barely walk, and everybody knows his mind is still all right. And yet the young love him. Now, I have to give you a very interesting little experience. A week ago, today, I went to my dentist in Hamburg. I have a wonderful dentist there. And the woman who saw clean my teeth started talking to me about God, which was very, very rare in Germany. Of course, I couldn't respond because she was fumbling with my gums and other things. But it turned out that she was one of the Pope's camp followers. Now, Hamburg is a traditionally Lutheran city where the Catholic Church is making major inroads among the young. Again, because of this new catechumenate that the Pope has created. And she and her husband are very, very, very active. Now, while the Lutheran Church of Hamburg has lost more than a third of its membership under the reign of the ruling bishop, who is a woman, who was the most ardent proponent of abortion rights and all that sort of thing, and they're continuing to lose members. The Catholic Church, the Catholics actually elevated Hamburg to the state of an archdiocese. They have an archbishop there now, even though there were hardly any Catholics at the beginning of World War II in that city and state. And it is all has all to do with the Pope, this particular Pope, and his very, very straight line on issues. And on he has credibility, and the others haven't.
Uwe Simonetto, we thank you for your time, and I hope that you enjoy your time there in Dresden as well. Thank you for being our guest.
Thanks very much, Todd.
Uwe Simonetto, a native of Germany, religion editor for United Press International, joins us from Dresden, Germany. When we come back from this break, we're going to pick up on the subject that we just laid down, having to do with the Roman Catholic Church, not abroad, but here in America. This week in Denver, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops plan to meet. What will they discuss? What will they say, if anything, about at least two among their ranks who have decided to follow the Vatican's directive and to restrict communion, at least in theory, to Roman Catholic lawmakers who are pro-choice, and in the case of one, that being the bishop there in Colorado Springs, Colorado, perhaps even to parishioners who vote for such lawmakers. We'll talk about that with Helen Hull Hitchcock, founding director of a Catholic women's group called Women for Faith and Family, editor of the periodical Voices, and her husband, Dr. James Hitchcock, professor of history at St. Louis University, after this.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The entire Old Testament points forward to one thing: Jesus Christ and Him crucified for sinners. The Old Testament is really about the good news of Jesus Christ, the gospel. Is this true even of the Old Testament book of laws called Leviticus? Yes, it is. Find out how in our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Leviticus. If you'd like information on the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, visit our Issues, Etc. website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. Or order this commentary from Concordia Publishing House by calling them toll-free, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. When you call, mention Issues, Etc. It's the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Leviticus.
People from the lower caste in India have had little choice in their way of life. But this Global Minute lets you hear that speaking out against unfavorable policies has helped some people come to faith in Christ. A leading Christian from India, Vishal Mangalwadi, says that protesting unfair practices has given him friendships with many different families from the lower caste in India.
Thousands of house churches are emerging all over North India because the lower castes are now beginning to protest against the Hindu caste system and oppression.
Mangalwadi is now involved in a different project, which is producing videos and a book to show that the Bible will be the most influential book of the millennium. His target audience is secular, non-religious people in the West. Pray for Northern India. Get gospel updates from around the world by visiting the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave? It's just a piece of cloth. But this Flag Day, we remember that it's more than just a piece of cloth. It's a symbol of our history, often glorious, but not always so. Our continuing sacrifices for the common good and our aspiration for the future. Even higher than the national flag to which our eyes look up, our hearts are lifted to the banners of the eternal God. Psalm 60 says, "You have set up a banner for those who fear you, that they may flee to it from the bow, that your beloved ones may be delivered. Give salvation by your right hand." Song of Solomon says, "His banner over me is love." So while we live and work on this earthly side of Jordan, we are privileged to look up to the stars and stripes. And on both this side and on the other side, the side to which the Savior leads us, we live under that eternal banner of divine love. Psalm 20, verse 5 says, "May we shout for joy over your salvation, and in the name of our God set up our banners." Have a good Flag Day. I'm Dale Meyer.
Ever wish you could take KFUO with you on vacation or archive a favorite program on compact disc to hear again with a relative, friend, or study group? Visit KFUO.org for free downloads of the Bible study issues at Central, Law and Gospel, and Sunday sermons. These meaningful programs are available as free MP3 downloads to your computer from the AM850 KFUO website. Another way listener-supported worldwide KFUO serves you on the web at www.kfuo.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We are coming to you live this Monday afternoon. It's the 14th of June. On this day, well, during this week, there's going to be a rather significant meeting. We're going to find out how significant it is here as we begin our conversation with Helen Hull Hitchcock and her husband, Dr. James Hitchcock, this week's meeting in Denver of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. They're slated to talk about a number of things. Of course, the perennial topic is going to be the priestly abuse scandal. We'll get an update on that. But first and foremost, in the headlines, has to do with some among their own ranks who are deciding to carry a hard line, a consistent line, if you ask me, with Roman Catholic lawmakers who deviate from the church's teaching. And in the case of one of those bishops from Colorado Springs, Colorado, Bishop Sheridan, perhaps even the parishioners who vote for them. Helen Hull Hitchcock is founding director of a Catholic women's group called Women for Faith and Family, and her husband, Dr. James Hitchcock, professor of history at St. Louis University. Together, they are regular guests here on Issues Etc. Helen, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much.
And Dr. Hitchcock as well, welcome to you.
Thank you.
First of all, Dr. Hitchcock, tell us, what is the gravity, officially, of this week's meeting of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops in Denver?
Well, actually, Helen can probably answer that better because she usually goes there as a journalist, although not this year. It's a disputed question that has been around for a long time. These conferences are, in a certain sense, official, but in another sense, they're not. And as Archbishop Burke of St. Louis has sort of indicated this week, if the bishops' conference were to come out with a statement saying you should not deny communion to pro-abortion politicians, he would not change his own position. He said, I would change my position if ordered to do so by the Vatican. And there are those who will try to make the National Conference of Bishops sort of the governing body, but then other bishops who say, no, it's an informal, well, not informal, but it's an non-binding, let's put it that way.
There was a clarification a couple of years ago on the authority of conferences that came out from Rome, and the that clarification said that only on things that at least two-thirds of the bishops voted in favor of a particular policy was it to be binding on all bishops. Anything less than that was not considered, and then it would have to be approved by the Holy See as well. So a conference, what it's good for is to, when there are, especially when there are controversies, and there almost always are, although some of them in recent couple of years have been more severe than others, it helps to get the bishops, let's say, on the same page, or at least know what page each other are on. And it's also, in this particular meeting, the reason why press were not at this meeting was this was supposed to be a retreat where they weren't going to be discussing any big issues, but just being together as, you know, for more spiritual mutual support.
And how likely is that to really be what this meeting
is about?
But now,
with other, you know, with the couple of issues that have come up, and including this most recent one that we're not originally scheduled to be discussed at this meeting. So how much retreat they're going to get out of this one, I don't know. There are probably a lot of reporters who wish they were there checking up on them.
Now, Helen, I'm curious if you could just give us the basic rundown on the position of both St. Louis Archbishop Raymond Burke, who was first to emerge on the scene as he was making the transition from Wisconsin, La Crosse, to St. Louis on the issue of communing Roman Catholic lawmakers who deviate from the Church's teaching, very recently joined by Bishop Michael Sheridan of Colorado Springs. Give us the rundown on the position of these two men.
Well, actually, Archbishop Burke was then Bishop of La Crosse, and he was challenged openly by two politicians who were militantly pro-abortion and persistently so, and he had written letters to them and had meetings with them, and they would not desist. So in accordance with Catholic teaching, which was most recently enunciated clearly in a doctrinal note from the Holy See a couple of years ago, he issued them these warnings, and then he said, well, and if you are not going to change your mind, then you should not present yourself for communion. And that really was about it. And then he issued a public statement which said that Catholics must unite their consciences and with their voting record, and that they couldn't, there's not a separation. They don't have two consciences, one for Sunday and one for every other day. So that was pretty much his statement. It happened that that escalated because of the probable candidacy of John Kerry. So then that became his La Crosse politicians thing became public. He was not the first by any means, however. I don't know if you remember last year Bishop William Wiegand,
yes,
in Sacramento issued a very strong statement and did not permit the then governor to receive communion. That was challenged, but that was not the first either. This issue goes back some years, actually. And in the month of May, I think there were about 20 bishops who made statements of one kind or another on it. It was it's very interesting. I kept track of that because the Women for Faith and Family website has a section called Catholics and Political Responsibility, where we have kept track of all of that. And it might be interesting for some of your listeners to check that out if they're interested.
Dr. Hitchcock, now Bishop Michael Sheridan has most recently got the headlines on this, and his statements seem to go, at least as far as I can tell, just a bit beyond Burke or any other of his fellow bishops on the issue of Roman Catholic lawmakers and even parishioners who might vote for them. Tell us about that.
Well, Bishop Sheridan stated that those who vote for a politician who supports abortion ought not to receive communion. That, of course, was originally understood as saying, well, I'm going to deny you communion. Then, of course, Bishop Sheridan pointed out the obvious, which is, I don't know how people voted. That's a private matter. But he is saying, your conscience should tell you that you've done something wrong and you should not receive communion. There's one big precedent that I can think of for this offhand, and that is in 1948, a very crucial election in the post-war period. Pope Pius XII forbade Catholics in Italy to vote for the Communist Party, and that is thought to have had a major effect in making sure communist government did not come to power that year. It's not totally unprecedented that I know of.
No, well, not only that, but come to think of it, I just was looking something last week. There was an archbishop in the 1950s when desegregation was was the issue, not abortion. Archbishop Rummel of New Orleans actually excommunicated three Catholic politicians who had openly opposed him when he desegregated the Catholic schools. And he announced that desegregation would end, and they persisted. And so after that, Rummel and his coadjutor, Bishop John Cody, who later was Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago, warned them that they would be excommunicated, and they persisted, and they actually excommunicated them. Now, excommunication is different from just denying someone communion or saying that a person should not go to communion because they're in a state of sin. Because excommunicating means that you're barred not just from Mass and communion, but from all the sacraments as well as Catholic burial. So there is that, and I think a lot of people are confused about that distinction. So they think, well, if someone that someone is being excommunicated when they're told not to go to communion until they get their act together.
So how
incident that Helen referred to, by the way, of Archbishop Rummel, say quickly here, was strongly applauded by liberals at that time. This was thought by liberals, both secular and religious, to be a very wise, prudent, moral exercise of religious authority. And the fact that that's now deliberately forgotten, I think, simply shows the issue has changed. You sometimes hear people saying, well, they ought to come down hard on Catholic politicians who support capital punishment, meaning that the liberal Catholics who are against capital punishment would favor that. The only reason they don't like what Archbishop Burke is doing is because they tend often themselves to be pro-abortion.
Now, Vatican Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger is quoted in the press as having, when he was visited by some U.S. bishops, told them to be cautious about denying communion to Catholic politicians, and some have interpreted this as a suggestion that Rome is a bit worried about where bishops like Burke and Sheridan might be going. What is Rome's position? What is the Vatican's position
on
this?
Could I just say here, this is one thing that I think that we have a phenomenon here that we didn't have maybe even the last election, and that is the prominence of the instant communication on the Internet. There is no real evidence that Cardinal Ratzinger actually said that. He may have said that he wants to talk to the people who are involved, but what Cardinal Ratzinger would do would be to reinforce what that doctrinal note that his congregation issued 2 years ago. And let me just quote one sentence from it. It states emphatically this: continuing in the constant teaching of the Church, John Paul II has reiterated many times that those who are directly involved in lawmaking bodies have a grave and clear obligation to oppose any law that attacks human life. For them, as for every Catholic, it is impossible to promote such laws or to vote for them. So that does not name any names, but what is fundamental is the issue, and that is that anybody who is involved as a politician or as a voter has a grave and clear obligation to oppose any law that attacks human life. So the only thing the congregation would do, the only thing the Vatican could do, is to reaffirm that. Now, where they would come down on interdictions or threats of excommunication, but we're not even talking about that yet because nobody has threatened excommunication or any formal interdiction. What they've done is to put it very strongly on the conscience of individual Catholics to perform in the way that the Catholic Church teaches.
We're talking about this week's meeting of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops with Helen Hull Hitchcock and her husband, Dr. James Hitchcock. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. A couple more questions on this. And by the way, folks, you're listening to Issues Etc., and I'm Todd Wilkin. This, another question here is, the Americans for the Separation of Church and State, Barry Lynn, has decided to take up this issue and cast the action of both Burke and Sheridan and others as stepping over the line and perhaps even challenge some of their congregation's IRS status, because he says this is just plain politicking. No one needs to mention John Kerry's name. No one needs to mention George Bush's name. Everyone understands who they're talking about, and this crosses the line. How do you respond, Helen?
Well, I would say in a way that's an indictment against a party that is so easily identifiable by its issues. Another one who did that is an organization that calls itself Catholics for a Free Choice. In fact, they have said in a public letter that the bishops being not all being on the same page on this issue shows that abortion is not really a matter of grave sin anymore.
I think that Barry Lynn, I regard that organization as quite hypocritical, because, again, they always come down on it when it's involved with more conservative issues and not liberal ones. But I don't think Barry Lynn would really like to go down that road, because look at all the churches. I mean, John Kerry and other Democratic candidates have been traveling around the country actually preaching from the pulpit of various churches on Sunday morning. You can't get a more obvious link of politics and religion than that. And, of course, the Americans for Separation of Church and State are not calling for the removal of tax exemptions from those groups.
And, Helen, how have Roman Catholics, either the bishops or the parishioners, developed what you called earlier this dual conscience, one for the parish, one for the public square? How did that come about?
Well, I think Jim, as a historian, would probably be better at answering that, but I think that it's partly because the culture has drifted away from the moral principles by which, it was assumed that we were established, and that those have been challenged in the last several decades, and there is no longer a kind of an assumption that we all believe that marriage is between one man and one woman, that all children are valuable, that abortion is terrible. I mean, everybody thought that assumed that. So the culture has shifted, and a lot of people have shifted with it, whereas the churches have not. They continue to maintain
Well, some of the churches. I think it goes back really to John Kennedy, who believed that in order to get elected, he would have to assure people that he would not let his religion influence his politics. Then I think what happened after that was, beginning in around 1970, the Democratic Party became totally enthralled to extreme feminists. And the pro-abortion groups, if you pay attention, during the recent Democratic primary, for example, when you had five or six candidates, they were vying with one another, the candidates, who could be more pro-abortion than the other one. The higher that the extreme feminists raised the bar, the higher the politicians jumped. And it's a well-known fact that you cannot expect to get ahead in the Democratic Party if you're pro-life, and that means that the Catholics in the party have got to abandon their moral principles.
I would like a reaction, a response from both of you to something that Barbara Blaine said yesterday. She is president of SNAP, Survivors Network for Those Abused by Priests. She says it's a shame that the bishops aren't meeting with abuse victims like they did 2 years ago. Here she is.
2 years ago, the bishops met with SNAP members and survivors. The cardinals met with SNAP members, and they committed themselves to open a dialogue with us, and we haven't heard from them since.
First of all, your reaction, Helen, and then Dr. Hitchcock, to her statements there about this most recent meeting of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops.
The one that's currently going on?
Yes.
Well, it's hard to know exactly what would satisfy the SNAP people's idea of dialogue. But I think that the bishops have bent over in every direction trying to solve the problem and to put a good face on it and to say we really do care about everybody and so on. As far as what they plan to do at this closed meeting that's taking place right now, I don't know. I imagine they will be reviewing some of the things that have taken place, you know, recently on that.
And Dr. Hitchcock, your response?
Well, I think meeting with the victims, of course, has some symbolic significance and probably makes people feel better. But I don't see that's the real issue. The real issue is how to prevent things like this from happening over in the future. One of the problems I have with SNAP is they seem to concentrate entirely on how shall we treat the victims. They have little or nothing to say about prevention. I think the real issue in Denver, and there's some dispute about that too, is how rigorous are the safeguards going to be? A year or so ago, it looked as though the bishops had adopted pretty rigorous procedures, and now it looks as though, to some extent, they're backing away. And that, to me, is a more important issue than whether or not they meet with SNAP people.
Helen, your thoughts on SNAP. You have, on this program, expressed some concern about other groups, not so much victims groups, but groups that chimed in from within American Catholicism during the priestly abuse scandal at its height, and yet their solutions were often things like revocation of the discipline of celibacy and the ordination of women. You've expressed your concern there. Any concerns about SNAP, per se?
It seems to me like, as far as I know, SNAP is pretty much single issue. And the other groups that we were talking about are groups that I may have mentioned were groups like Voice of the Faithful, that most of the members and organizers have an agenda, and it's a very opposing fundamental church teachings in other ways too. And it seemed to me that they were using this opportunity as an opportunity to garner support for their people who were angry at the church to support their views.
It seems to me that the criterion here is whether people recognize that the root of the abuse problem lies with homosexuality. If you're unwilling to acknowledge that that's the case, you're not part of the solution. To the best of my knowledge, SNAP has completely avoided that issue. I've never heard them pronounce anything about what they see as the causes of the problem.
What about the bishops?
The bishops, again, are very mixed on that. I think that the report that came out from the lay committee about a year or so ago was very strong and very clear on that question. And there have been some criticism recently by different bishops of that report, and you might say that the criticisms come from opposite sides, some of the more conservative bishops, also some of the more liberal bishops. The conservative bishops, in effect, arguing, look, we're in charge here. We can't turn over our responsibilities to a lay group. These would be bishops who would probably be willing to recognize homosexuality as a problem. But I think that is probably behind the scenes also a deeply divisive issue in Denver, and it remains to be seen what's going to happen there.
Now, for both of you, what else do you expect, and what would you hope would be discussed among the bishops at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops in Denver this week, beginning with you, Dr. Hitchcock?
Well, Helen could speak more meaningfully on this. Lots of liturgical problems in this country. I keep using the word divisive, and it's true. In different dioceses, people are getting contradictory instructions from their bishops as to how they are to conduct themselves in receiving communion and things of, I don't mean to say the abortion issue, but I mean just the simple posture, whether you should stand or kneel or whatever. That's something that that badly needs to be sorted out. And but as I say, Helen really knows a lot more about that than I do.
Well, Helen, there was a recent statement that came out. I believe it was from the Vatican, if I'm not mistaken, saying, "Look, we need to." And it was toned down, I think, in the course of about 2 weeks before it was officially put out. But it had to do with not so much abuses in the Mass, but irregularities in the practice of the Mass.
That's right. It was that document was issued. As a matter of fact, it triggered some of the controversy because in this long document, 185 paragraphs long, there were two paragraphs in it, and one of them said that anyone who is conscious of grave sin should not receive the body of the Lord without prior sacramental confession. Now, that wouldn't sound new to anybody who, you know, had been a Catholic, except that in this particular context, that also aroused some controversy over the politicians and Catholic politicians issue. But the Vatican has been very much concentrating on what they view as a loss of belief among people, Catholic people, in the meaning of the Eucharist itself, and the Pope has just announced that he's going to declare a Eucharistic year beginning in October. And he's just issued an encyclical on the meaning of the Eucharist, and all these instructions are very much related to that. We're also in the throes of retranslating the missal or the texts that are used at Mass and the scripture as well. So this has been a rough few years. I think it's important and it's transitional. I think it's, you know, some of the documents that have been issued on, for example, on translation and the Eucharist are foundational for the future and perhaps corrective of, one might say, 3 or 4 decades of rather confusion and mixed signals.
Finally, with only about 10 seconds for each of you, your reactions respectively to the President of the United States awarding Pope John Paul II the President's Medal of Freedom, I think it was.
Well, I think it was great. I think the role which the Pope played in the fall of communism, particularly in Poland, means that he very much merits it.
And Helen?
I would echo that and say that it was curious that it happened the day before President Reagan died, who was the closest collaborator of the Pope in achieving that accomplishment, and the Pope had actually mentioned to give his greetings to President Reagan the day before the President died.
The ironies of history, or the coincidence of history. Dr. James Hitchcock, thank you for being our guest, and Helen Hull Hitchcock, thank you as well for being our guest.
Thank you. Okay.
Helen Hull Hitchcock is founding director of a Catholic woman's group called Women for Faith and Family. They have a website she mentioned before where you can get an update on a lot of these issues taking place in the American Catholic Church, wf-f.org, wf-f.org. Dr. James Hitchcock is professor of history at St. Louis University. When we come back from this break, we begin Open Lines. We're going to hear from Reagan's Friday's funeral, some from the homily. I'd like your reaction to what you saw and heard. It's Open Lines after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.